Dear Jeff, now I go to your grave for comfort. Letters cut into stone. Name, birthday, death day. A triangle of granite with offerings at the foot. Once, someone left you a beer. In August, your brother and I plant chrysanthemums. In the autumn, we rip them out and leave a small pumpkin and bittersweet for Halloween. Our dog roams the other stones while I sit on your bones, having a conversation with the air.
Our bodies left for the night to wake into.
We'll be sitting around a table eating lasagna, or maybe walking down some dirt road in Virginia. Or maybe we're inside some dusty country store crammed with jams and t-shirts. Or we might be in the back seat of a taxi in New York City or a hotel conference room, or sitting next to each other in a plane preparing to take off. And that's when the question comes, the very normal question. So, Sharon, how many children do you have? And so I tell the person, I have two children, but one of them is dead. And then I get the look, always the same look. It's a kind of blanching. It's like they pull their hand away from the flame, and I don't blame them. I don't blame them because that question, how many children do you have? It's like this unlit candle I carry around, never knowing who will have the match. So then they ask, because they feel they have to ask, how did your son die? Of course, you don't have to say if you don't want to. And maybe they don't want me to. And of course, I don't want to, but I do want to, so I tell them the story. He fell 45 feet from a bridge in Rome, the Ponte Sisto, above the River Tiber. And then I can hear them thinking, oh my God, suicide, which is not what happened. But they won't know that unless I tell them more of the story, so I tell them more. How thrilled he was to be a student in Rome, his asthma, dinner with my husband, the branch in his hand, the branch from the tree that he grabbed on the way down. And their eyes are so kind now. They are so full of happiness. That their own children are still alive. And then they want to know how long ago. So I tell them he's been dead longer than he's been alive. He died a few days before turning 21. And sometimes I start to sob, surprising myself, causing the other person to back away or hug me or try to comfort me. And it doesn't do any good, really. So then the conversation turns to what someone's husband does, or what book they're reading, maybe what school their child goes to. We're trying to tell our stories, aren't we? And I smile, and I listen. And all these candles are burning inside me. Even though it's been so long, so very long, I don't know how to put those candles out. I think often about the relationship between poetry and weeping. Is it a dance or a boxing match or some kind of conspiracy, a lamentation, the lacrimosa, weeping transformed into song? And then song transformed into poetry, and if the song is any good, well, then suddenly there's pleasure in the mix too. Or maybe sometimes I find my way back to the pleasure of life through being really, really good at singing the lamentation. And that's when grief becomes an absolute purity, within the borders and without cacophony. Everything slow, like the shimmer of heat off summer asphalt. Everything dry, like grains of dirt in a drought. A hummingbird whirring at the honeysuckle, hollyhocks higher than the barn roof, all equal here, a shared condition. Doesn't everyone die? Doesn't everyone seek rapture? And there is rapture, really, in these lamentations, the untainted longing, and the total clarity. the utter, immaculate emptiness. For a long time, there were signs. The note that said, "It's a gift," signed with his name, Jeff, from the man who'd cut up our wounded oak for nothing. The new license plate on the Subaru, all the letters and numbers adding up to the day he was born. And the dreams. Him at age 10, almost always. Except for the one when he lectured me, "Don't blame anyone or anything for my death." I wasn't ready to be finished with death. I wasn't ready not to find him everywhere. So I made myself into several women. The one who shuffled the raw wild cards of loss. The one who was terrified to live with mercy and forgiveness. The one who lived only to take care of the dead child. My dead son's friends come for a visit. They are grown men now with paunches and good jobs. We hug and drink red wine, eat eggplant and polenta. Our dead son's letters are in a blue file in a room above our heads. The autopsy report in a plastic black bag on the closet floor. David says he has a surprise. A recording from college. A night when they were packing to leave for Rome. Strumming guitars, laughing. "I've got his voice," he says. "Do you want to hear it?" Of course we do. We settle into the couch, lean on the big pillows and prepare to listen. He pushes buttons, sounds come, and music. And the voices of boys so young and happy, they all sound the same. "There he is," one of them says. "Can you hear him?" But I already know I can't catch it, that I've lost this melody, what my dead son sounded like when he was alive. So I'm holding in my hand Jeffrey's high school yearbook. It's a big, heavy, blue book. You know, it's your typical yearbook. It's got pages. Starts out with teams and candids and whatnot. And Jeff is, I put a paper clip to mark his page. And here he is. He's wearing a fedora and aviator glasses, and he's against some sort of psychedelic background. He must be in front of a poster or a piece of fabric with a wild pattern or something. And he's smiling. And in this picture, he really does look like he's smiling. And he has two quotes. The first is from Nikos Kazantzakis, and the second one is from Simon and Garfunkel. How terribly strange to be 17, but in the Simon and Garfunkel song, the line is, "How terribly strange to be 70, 70, not 17," and I wondered, is it a typo? Is it a... some sort of mistake? Did Jeffrey always think that Simon and Garfunkel were saying 17 rather than 70? Or maybe he put down 17 deliberately because he knew somehow that he wouldn't reach 70 or anywhere near that. What's also, when I look at this page, what's also interesting is on the next page, there's a student who's clearly a jokester who's wearing just a big mask. And then next to that student is another student who is leaning against a rather large tombstone. All on my son's page. Nothing fits. I'm disappearing. Even my lips are thin. I'm learning from them how to kiss a man again. In Italy last year, I was apprenticing. I filled these clothes out then, a mother still full of her dead son. We walk to the wall you fell from, four trees down from Ponte Sisto. My heart is cold against the stone. Everyone else is sweating. My husband takes my hand. The grass is 10 years higher. The sycamores are taller. We climb down to the Tiber, one white flower blooming where you landed. I arrange roses in a boy's shape. England, green and sheep, birds in hedgerows. I'm here to breathe, my room a single bed and chest. The nuns have left their convent to the birds and us. My memories of you. The walls are stone, nothing happens. The days go by. I hike the lanes to Denbury, listen to the sheep bleat. I dream I am a girl in a burn unit, wrapped in plastic. Tonight I heard a small explosion outside our window, slicing through the dark with a storm of stars. A tree, I thought. A tree falling on wires we'd had rain for weeks. Our huge silver maple 90 years old behind our house. The wound in its side, as big as my dead son's body, and a thick tumble on the ground made from trunk, bark, and branch. So thick, I cannot see the road beyond. Each spring, his ghost blooms with the lilacs. Nothing can chase that ghost away. Not the bluebirds in the backyard, not the ravenous tulips, nor the luminous acres of lawn. The ghost brings death to the newly born. It's not that I forget him in winter, but winter's flowers are underground, sheltered by hard earth, but when they burst out every spring, I can't hide. His death sounds its arrival with dogwood and daffodils, while I, now gray-haired and lined, survive at winter's edge, unwilling to outlive him. And so it is that every spring my dead son whistles Rockin' Robin in the patio in Siena with us. Every spring, my dead son doesn't graduate from college. Every spring, my dead son lies down on the wall in Trastevere and doesn't know what happens next. Listen to me now, because this is the voice of a mother whose baby was dying as it was being born. I didn't listen when death was talking to me. He stalked the flowers in my garden. He filled the ground with seed. And he murmured at the celebrations. He brought me two baskets. In one, he said, put what is already dying. In the other, what is not yet dead. But they are both the same, I said. Now I use one basket for what I don't know, and the other for all I have lost. There is no end to this. Behind the mountain, dense clouds. I come out into the sun, and it leaves. Four trees down from Ponte Sisto, lying on his left side, branch in his hand. It was late. Wall of mossy marble blocks. 45 feet up, and there were sycamores. He missed his exam. Madam, I'm afraid some bad news.
No, not my son. Madam, I'm afraid it is. Did I say he was lying on his left side? It was late. We tried to put his earring in his left ear, but it's too swollen. Did he scream coming down? Did he cry? Mom, Dad, help. He bled to death in the night, alone. Mom, Dad, are you there? My child, here at last, in a box. White sheets wrap you. They've washed your hair.
I thought you would come back as something, maybe as your brother's baby, or the rose bush somebody gave me for my birthday, or the white hawk that circled our backyard, or the lab puppy we got 2 years after you died. But the rose bush shriveled, and the hawk doesn't come anymore. The baby is too much like his father, not you. The puppy, maybe the puppy, though he's grown into a sweet old beast who will surely die within the year. Will that mean you will be twice gone? Some days I know I can hear you. Just last month in Greece, the stack of bones in the sarcophagus. Dad says that's what you are now. And then there was the purple cyclamen, blooming so improbably on the rocky path, and the red and white boat, just like yours, on the beach near Stavri. All those signs said the same thing. Mom, they said, listen to me. I've led you this far. Keep going. And so I say to the bones and the flowers, I want you to know something about your mother now. I have undone the padlock of your death. But Jeffrey, I want to see you in your t-shirt and jeans, the red bandana tied around your brown hair. I want to hear you whistle. Tell me jokes, to see you walk across a room towards me, smiling. I want you to come back as yourself, not as a boat, a bird, or a pile of bones. On one visit to Rome, I'm invited to give a reading at my dead son's school. The molded plastic orange chairs are arranged in tidy semicircles. I take off the soft leather jacket I'd bought this afternoon on the Via del Corso, put my books and my poems on the podium. I'm wearing a black suit and red shoes. The kids begin to arrive. The same age Jeff was when he sat on one of those very same chairs all those many years ago. Some of the teachers come too. The room is full. My host introduces me by saying that Elliot was wrong about April, that May is the cruelest month, the month Jeff fell from the wall on the night before his final exam. It is very still when I begin. Poems about saying no when we get the news, about how hard it must have been for him to travel with his parents when he'd been on his own all year. He told us, my life is with my friends now. Poems about the autopsy, about choosing the cemetery plot, about the funeral, about how spring only recalls death. Everyone is so quiet. I finish the reading and ask if anyone wants to speak. Ask anything. No one does. The kids just look stunned. I think I can see Jeff among them. Over there, over in the third row on the left.
Night. Breathing.
It's worn and is fading, but it's something that Jeffrey wrote when he was 14. A family is a shapeless blob which is carefully sculpted and crafted. It slowly develops dimensions, yet it is constantly changing and remains unfinished. The sculptors aren't experienced, so there are many flaws, externally and internally. I love the part where he says, "I burst with pride. To have them as a family between us is a constant friendship to which we can turn in times of depression. We have the past to look back on and the future to look forward to." It's all in capital letters, and I think the family as a blob is it's something that's kind of like an amoeba, maybe, and it kind of changes form and shape, but it's this elemental part of who we all are, and that it's constantly changing. Roles are changing, people. You notice that he goes on and says that the family is a shapeless blob, but then he says that it is carefully sculpted and crafted. The sculptors aren't experienced, so there are many flaws.
Love and I, it must be.
I drag your death after me. The detail is a kind of communion. I take you in. Day after day, your body becoming my body. We are commingled in a way that would not be allowed if you were alive. I remember the phone call from the embassy with me screaming no. Your face, the airport, our questions. One red gladiola smashed in the center of the courtyard at the morgue. I remember us alone in the dark room. When you were wrapped in white sheets, I stood over you like Mary, as if you were a new baby blessedly fresh into the world. But it was your death that was fresh in the room, like some terrible gift that would be unwrapped again and again, a gift that never stopped giving, though I didn't know that then. Didn't know how I would bring you home, where I would put you, how we would live with this awful present. If I lived in Sicily, after 20 years, they'd give me back your bones. How would they bring them to me? In plastic shopping bags, in the back seat of a Fiat, in a wheelbarrow with mud on the tires. Would I wear black to receive them? Give me those bones, I'd say. Let them sing in my hands. I'd lay them out on the floor and make you all over again. I'd start with the ribs, they covered your heart. Then the arms, those long bones. Then the fingers, did they break when you fell? Then your legs, thigh bones, tibia, fibula. I'd make a necklace of your broken bits. A wreath for the door.
With ragged breathing, with rip.
There's a quote that I love from Karen Armstrong's History of God. It would have saved me a great deal of anxiety to hear that instead of waiting for God to descend from high, I should deliberately create a sense of him for myself. And that's what I do. Choose something to believe within myself. And then I believe it.
Breaking.
Yes, there were times, dark times. Like when Jeff was bullied and picked on at his very prestigious and expensive high school. I remember there was one class where he wrote an essay about death. The assignment was what it would feel like to have 24 hours to live. He wrote that it would be okay, so long as he was with his family. His teacher gave him a failing grade. He said he was sorry that such a sensitive theme must fail. There were other tough times in the family, too. And Jeff was so sensitive, he felt everything for all of us. But not in Rome. Not then. I mean, we had just been with him. He was happy and strong. I don't know why he took off his glasses and his shoes. He had asthma. It was late. He had been out with his friends. They were drinking wine. Maybe he just needed to lean over the wall for a second to catch his breath. And then lost his balance. The autopsy says the most reliable hypothesis is that of an accidental death. That's what I choose to believe, and I believe it.
When they do my own autopsy, I know what they are going to find. They will find 4 promises strangled in gall, 9 broken rules buried in the liver. There will be green tea running in my veins, and between my ribs, they will find an entire dinner service for 8. In my left breast, they will find 10 pairs of black pumps and a Tiffany fork in a corner of my kidney. They will find 16 unpaid bills inside the muscle tissue of my right thigh and a variety of small mammals under my fingernails. And then, finally, lodged among the vertebrae, they will find my one dead son. When Jeff fell from the bridge, I fell too. And when I hit the stones, parts of me they left. They went somewhere else. They went somewhere to be safe. Because that's what happens when you fall like that, so far down without dying. Sometimes they come for a visit. For example, just now I ate oatmeal with apples. The mowed field is under snow, and my husband holds me in. His rough vest scratches my skin. I don't run, but want to, feeling the thin young man stirring inside him, and I want to run, but I don't. She's gone, that girl, isn't she? The one who sucked the sky through a straw. The one who bled. The one who wanted God to love her. The bowl of my body empty now. Blood stopped. Baby dead. Must I rewind her? And how would I do that? How does that work? I try to think her under the snow. Reduce her to a hard red stone. She brings me melons, pomegranates, prayers. She won't leave me alone. She's gone, but she won't leave me alone.
Breaking everything. Moments.
After the fall, blood blossoms on the cheap rayon lining of the leather jacket he bought in Florence. All around him, the Tiber's birthings. Empty syringes, broken wine bottles, sticky condoms, skin of a dead rat. There are echoes beneath the Ponte Sisto. A wall looms near. Was the moon interested? Did anyone see him fall? Did he call out Mom, Dad, screaming into the hot Roman night? Now he will be replaced by information, memory, imagination. He will be replaced by a straw bag of letters and cards. A blue file folder in an oak drawer. He will be replaced by therapists, broken vows, too many glasses of wine. He will be replaced by trains and planes, a Land Rover bumping over a narrow road in Costa Rica, grilled sardines in Portugal, Rigoletto performed outside in Prague. he will be replaced by a granite gravestone, two new houses, a black dog, his brother's marriage, 500 American soldiers killed in Operation Iraqi Freedom, a barn full of dry wood burning, and by his grandmother's new heart. He will be replaced by a squirrel's nest made of black plastic and twigs. My son is bleeding to death, but don't worry. He will be replaced. Plunging with you through the thick Roman air,
breaking
every night for a year, falling into the story, a stampede racing to the earth,
breathing
each syllable uncoiled,
ragged,
our bodies left for the night to rip into,
tonight,
ragged with breathing, the future maybe a few more moments. Everything breaking.
Uncoiled.
What put us here?
Us put what?
Four trees down from Ponte Sisto. Poems and Recollections by Sharon Chard. Adapted for radio by Gregory Whitehead. Performed by Anne Underland, with music and sound design by Gregory Whitehead. Executive producer for the BBC, Jeremy Mortimer.